and welcome to the latest Science of Thought podcast. I'm your host, Matt Solomon, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Brian Mann. So Brian is a strength and conditioning coach and educator. He's worked all over the US and a wide variety of fantastic university locations. Next to that, he's also published a book on powerlifting, which makes him the perfect person today to discuss how you can use momentum to improve your sporting performance. So without further ado, it's time to welcome Brian onto the show. So Brian, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Matt. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you very much for joining us. So can you give us a quick introduction as to who you are and what you've been up to until now?
Yeah, man. My name is Brian Mann. Some people call me Dr. Mann. I really don't give two rips. I am a strength coach who went and got a PhD and now is trying to educate others. You know, I'm from, I always say I'm a poor white boy from the backwoods, Oklahoma. You know, grew up in a trailer. You know, found early on what I wanted to do, due to my birthmark. You know, I was getting, because I know this is an international podcast and I don't know, I'm probably not like internationally known or anything, but I got a big red birthmark on my face that, you know, kids are cruel. They used to make fun of me. So I thought if I got bigger and stronger than all of them, they'd stop. And that really is what happened. So, you know, I started lifting weights at age 12 and then, tried to figure out the best way to do it, which led me to some of Doc Kreese's work and eventually to some others and strength and conditioning. And I fell in love with it. So, you know, while a lot of people by age 13, 14, they have no idea what they wanted to do, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And the last, 30 years of my life or so have been 31 years have been dedicated towards that. The pushing of human performance, along the lines of, in powerlifting, you know, I did pretty well there. I wrote the book for Human Kinetics on powerlifting, with Dan Austin. I coached at with Southwest Missouri. Now it's called Missouri State. That's where I actually started coaching while I was an undergrad student. But we have to realize that that was a different era. I mean, that was, one coach, 23 sports, 500 and some odd athletes. One guy.
How was your individualized programming there?
Individual
programs?
No. Whoa, it was sport based, but there was no individualization. And even with the two of us, you know, that's still there was not much individualization there. You know, we'd have three or four teams in the weight room at one point in time, man. It was just as much learning how to be an air traffic controller as it was a strength coach sometimes. And went from there to Arizona State, where I worked for Joe Ken, who actually just texted me busting my chops about my receding hairline. It's like, yeah, you need to, it's Custer's last day. And I'm like, yeah, no kidding. If my head were smooth and round, I'd go for it. But right now I can't do it. from there I went to University of Tulsa under Pat Ivey, back to Missouri State for a year. And then I spent 15 years at the University of Missouri. As a coach and faculty, after I got my PhD, which I don't recommend to anybody. If you're going to get a PhD, get a PhD. If you're going to coach. If you happen to have one of those embedded roles, great, but don't try and do both full time. That was, that was stupid. I got through it. From there, there were some things that happened at Mizzou, that were, you know, national news type of thing that caused a big budget crisis. And I ended up going to University of Miami, where I ended up being a dual role there as well. The program director for exercise physiology. And then I went on to be the director of sports science for Olympic sports. Eric Renahan had football. I covered the Olympic sports as best I could there. I happened to give a talk here and at Texas A&M. And I spouted my mouth off that, you know, my sister only lives an hour and 20 minutes from here. My cousin lives an hour and 40, you know, you guys and some other family members too. And they're like, you know, if you wanted to be here, we could make that a reality pretty quick. And I thought they were just talking smack and boy, was I wrong. So that's how I got here to Texas A&M is running my mouth. And, sometimes, you know, at least I haven't written a check that my body couldn't cash yet, fortunately, in any respect. But, so that's how I'm here at Texas A&M. teaching the next level. And here I'm technically just an academic. So we've got a master's in strength and conditioning, sport physiology with an emphasis in strength and conditioning. So it's already up, but we're getting it going through CASCI to be accredited. And yeah, some things need to be revamped. The previous guy had a heart attack and passed away about 5 years ago, I think, 6 years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of things that have changed in that time. And we're trying to get everything up and going and, you know, trying to fill Dr. Mike Greenwood's shoes. And those are some big shoes to fill for my size 10 and a half, 4Es here. But, you know, I'm doing the best that I can.
Absolutely excellent. And obviously what today we're going to discuss momentum and speed, right? So
fantastic.
You've kind of given us a nice story about how you got to where you are, but what's your interest then in speed and momentum? Where does that come from?
Man, you know where it came from is with a lot of stuff. It started out with like VBT type things. Like I have figured out way back in the day that if we wanted to find power on a vertical jump, well, we didn't have force plates, but we had a tendo, and I put a little tether around there, and I, you know, had to keep pushing that double up and down button at the exact right time to change the weight and move it up and down. And then from there I realized that the guy that I wrote the APRE paper with, his name was Steve Sayers. And I don't know if you've heard of the Sayers equation before, but I happened to be going across trying to figure out some way to do this more effectively using jump height. And I'll be damned if the Sayers equation wasn't there. And I got to thinking way back then, it's like, okay, great. I can do that for vertical jump, but I don't have 40 yards of tether for the tendo. So what can we do here? And it wasn't until I was just sitting there about, golly, 7 years ago, something like that. And I was just thinking about, like, you know, looking at some different math stuff. And I'm like, what all could we calculate here? Well, if I got distance and I got time, that gives me a velocity. And I was thinking about force and mass times acceleration initially. But it turns out, for talking with a lot of bioengineers who may have just been overcomplicating things, that, hey, you can't account for the friction in the ground. You can't account for the wind resistance. You can't account for pitch grade. You can't account for this, that, and the other. So they're like, hey, that's going to be a non-valid real means of doing that. But if you just multiply your mass times your velocity, you got momentum. And I went and I looked that up and I'm like, holy shit. And it turns out that that equation is those same units, excuse me, are true for impulse as well. So that's why, you know, you'll hear about the impulse momentum equations, because they're the same thing mathematically. But that, yeah, that's how I figured it out. And then I'm like, oh my God, how am I this stupid that it took me from 2004 until like 2018 to figure this out? I was just talking to my students today in the master's class, like, guys, this physics and math, learn it. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, you think that there is nothing to it. But if you can understand how to calculate different things, you're going to be able to gain a much better depth and breadth with the data that you already collect, instead of having to go and collect 25 different things. Well, we collect five and we calculate the rest of them that we need. And that's being facetious. You know, I don't know what those 25 would and those five would be, but it just goes to show that if you learn math and you learn physics, it'll really help you as a strength and conditioning coach, because you'll understand work, force, momentum, power, velocity, acceleration. And once you understand all of those things, the world becomes your oyster in terms of training and training adaptation.
Absolutely excellent. So when we take a couple of those parameters, then we take speed, for example. Speed gets a lot of attention in sport. So fastest 40 yard or whatever it is for the NFL, for football, soccer, it's a little bit different. But yeah, speed gets most of the attention. Is that then justified?
You know, I don't think that it's necessarily unjustified, because speed is a easy component to get. And in some situations, it absolutely matters. For some of the positions that I can't speak well for rugby or for the international football, I could do a little bit there, but not. I can't do much with rugby. I don't even know all the position names. I like to watch it and watch them knock the crap out of each other. But you know, as far as having a good grasp of the game, it would make Ashley Jones probably, you know, shake his head hearing that. I don't know that I'm overstating. It's like, I don't know all the positions. Yeah, I probably do, but I don't understand the strategy of the game other than try and get the damn ball across the line, which is pretty much the same as in football. But I think that for some of the positions, definitely speed is going to be the most important thing. You know, like the 40-yard dash became a test because 40 yards was the average punt of Paul Brown's punter. So he was looking to see who could be his outside two cover guys be. At that point in time, yes, of course, speed is the only thing that matters, going from point A to point B. But it's not just speed that matters for most of the positions. The interiors, the bigs, the mids. Those guys, it turns out that in my research that'll be coming out soon, that shows that momentum is a big factor. You know, speed is a factor, obviously, because it goes into momentum. But if you have a 250-pound player that ran a 4.8 and a 330, so hold on, you're probably mostly international people. So if I have a 110-kilo guy or I have a 130-kilo guy, you know, who, and they both run 4.8, who are you going to want to get hit by? Well, the lighter one, the bigger one's going to hurt more, right? Because he possesses more momentum. And I think that in terms of sports selection, that momentum is important. So is sprint speed for some places, for some positions. So I think momentum is important. But I think that in terms of looking at your total long-term athletic development model, that momentum is actually far more sensitive to change than is your sprint times, because, you know, and I can't speak for international strength and conditioning, but in the States, one of the things that I grew up hearing from the pioneers is you get them bigger and stronger until they slow down. Well, if they're maintaining the same speed, keep getting them bigger and stronger. When they slow down, that's whenever you change stimuli. And I've found that to be absolutely true. The Alver Meals of the world, the Al Millers, the Johnny Parkers, you know, these guys were right. They were right on the money. Because if you're getting bigger and you're maintaining speed, well, mass times velocity is momentum. You want to have as much momentum as you can. And you'll still be able to cut, still be able to get out there and go on the field time after time. That, you know, momentum to me is king. You know, and that really comes to us from our strength training, right? How do we get bigger? Well, we add muscle. How do we add muscle? Well, we lift weights. Do we lift light weights or heavy weights? Well, that depends on the outcome goal that you're looking for. If you're looking for force, you're going to be lifting heavy weights. If the only thing that matters is standing on stage in a pair of Speedos oiled up, then of course you're going to go the lighter weight to induce greater hypertrophy. So, you know, we want to make sure that everything's contractile. So that's really that mass velocity relationship right there, is you get stronger until you slow down. You get bigger until you slow down. And I should say that getting bigger, we've got to make sure that we're caring about the right kind of mass, right? We're not just talking about going to buffet and eating everything that you can and putting on a bunch of fat mass. No, that might provide inertia, but that won't provide, that's not going to provide anything else. You know, you're not going to see an increase in speed, an increase in power from that. But in, you know, as far as I'm concerned, momentum and power are going to be our two biggest factors in terms of sporting performance, so much so that Kramer and Fry back in the early 90s, I think it was like 91 or 93, they wrote a paper where they basically had everybody send in their data, their profiles. And they were looking at, could we tell the difference between teams in the top 25 and not in the top 25? And it wasn't strength numbers. It wasn't speed numbers. It wasn't bench press or anything. It was power. Right. They just use the Hartman equation to calculate power. And while they couldn't rank the teams that were in the top 25, the teams that were in the top 25 had more power than the teams that were not in the top 25. So, you know, it's not just one pure metric. You know, it's not just sprint times that matter. Because if I have a dude that's 5'2 Gosh, I have no idea what that would be in meters. Like, I don't know.
150.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe. That was like, I was or thinking 60. That was like 5'5". I have no idea. But if I have that little short dude and he weighs 120, but he runs a 4.2 36 meter dash, well, he's super fast, but he's never going to see the field because he's not big enough. Right. Conversely, I could have somebody who's 7 feet tall, right? Whatever meter that is, 2 meters tall, and they weigh 200 kilos. They're going to have but they can't sprint. They can't move. They're not going to be a good player either. It's the finding the intermixing. Well, a lot of people call these types of things fluff metrics. Like, dude, to me, that's where the performance lies. It's in the interaction of the two. In the pure metrics, we lose a lot of stuff. You know, if we look at just the speed, then that throws away the size of the individual. If we look at just the size of the individual and we don't look at how well they move, then that takes away that whole, you know, skill and movement component. So you got to have both. And here I am feeling like Buddy Morris. You ask one question, I go on for 15 minutes without even taking a breath.
Breathe. It's all good. And I'm interrupting Brian very rudely and very briefly to make sure that you're up to date on the Science of Sport Coach Academy. My Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses, which are broken down into bite-sized chunks. That means you can fit them in and around your busy coaching schedule. So if you're enjoying today's podcast and you want to get your hands on some more great sports science information, all you have to do is hit the link in the show notes and you get in there completely for free for the next 7 days. So hit that link when we finish with the podcast. And back to Brian. So when you've got, let's say you've got someone who's fast enough, right? You're starting to put muscle mass on them. And they maintain that speed. So let's say that training is going well, right? At the moment that they then start to decrease in their speed, still increasing in mass, what do you then do as a coach to change things up? Because you mentioned then you're going to change the stimulus, right? So what do you do at that point?
Well, then I'd be looking less at force and then more at stuff with like VBT. Instead of worrying just about strength, let's start worrying about strength speed and speed strength. So let's start to change the exercises up. It might be that they need to go from maybe they've been doing cleans forever. Well, maybe it's time to start doing snatch, something with a greater velocity emphasis. If you've just been doing straight weights, well, maybe might be a time to check at bands right now in addition to your regular resistance and try and hit the higher velocities. On the squats and the deadlifts and the things like that. I've heard of some people doing cleans with bands, and I'd be afraid to do that. I get it, and I get why they want to do it, but it's pulling the bar down faster too, so you better have a damn good high position to be able to catch that sucker. I've been wrong before, so hopefully I'm wrong about this with the cleans on that. But no, that's what I would be looking to do. It's improve sprinting and movement. Make sure that we're optimizing body composition, you know, because if they put on so much mass while they were maintaining their speed, what happened to their body fat percentage? Did that go up? Okay, well, great. Even if their percentage didn't go up, that still means they're carrying more fat mass. So maybe we need to look to decrease that. You know, if their relative strength is probably already over 2.5 times body weight, so we know that can't improve anymore. Let's look at some other measures. Let's look at some different exercises. Because, everybody is batty over the squat, and I am too. I think it's a fantastic exercise. And, you know, anybody who's seen any of my training over the past 25 years knows that, dude, I was a power lifter. They're going to squat, right? Well, that's just the name of the game. Well, whenever that squat quits driving the adaptations, maybe we need to look at things like joint angle specificity, right? So we might still be squatting, but now we might be doing half and quarter squatting, like in the paper about squat depth and that Matt Ray put out with Joe Kinn and Darren Krein, a couple of other NFL strength coaches a few years ago. Maybe it's that we need to look at the appropriate muscle, or maybe it's the force vector. Maybe we've squatted for so long that we need more horizontal component that could come from sleds or maybe hip thrust. Looking at some of that research that came out with Brett Contreras, maybe it's, you know, we've just got to look at a different stimulus. I have a feeling that it's no longer going to be increasing cross-sectional area in general strengths. I mean, shoot, Yuri Verkhoshansky taught us that back in the 1970s, that, hey, you know, that a general movement will cause a great transfer for a while, but it has a limited transfer. And whenever you reach that limit of the transfer, throwing more into that bucket doesn't buy you any further adaptations. We got to change. It might be change exercise. It might be change a trait within that exercise. You know, it might require a wholesale change of everything. I mean, shoot, Anatoly Bondarchuk used to say, every 5 years you have to change everything in your training just because you've adapted to it so well. And it might be that we have to start doing more what I would consider special exercises that solve the problems of that individual as opposed to a general exercise prescription. And what I mean by that is that, okay, well, maybe this person has a proximal hamstring issue and they're not able to start the fast, rapid force down. Well, then we could start doing an exercise like the pawback that Michael Yess has popularized way back in the day. And oddly enough, Brian Heiderscheidt found that that was the number one exercise to improve sprinting speed as well, completely independently and without any knowledge of Yeses's work, which to me was just it was just crazy. You know, they say truth lies in the overlap, and if you've got two biomechanists who train, you know, studied a lot of sprinting, and they both independently came up with the same exercise. I don't even know if Heiderscheidt had ever heard of Yeses before that instance, that podcast that he did with Jay DeMayo. But Brian was like, "Oh yeah, no, that's the exact same thing that I found." And which was just crazy to me that, hey, but back to the point, you know, these special exercises, we've got to solve the problem with exercise, not expect that some general prescription that somebody wrote down 40 years ago is still going to work for every single person that comes across your threshold. It just simply isn't the case. So we have to look at those special cases. What's going to continue to improve this? Is it ballistics, which it probably is going to be if somebody's super strong already? Is it plyometrics, right? Which it very well could be for the greater stored and release of that, the greater release of that stored kinetic energy. Is it going to be the joint angle specificity? Well, I mean, we've seen a lot of studies where that does make a big difference. Yeah. So it just, you know, what's next is it depends on what the individual needs. Those general programs work fantastic until they don't work anymore. And then you have to use some forms of specificity to elicit the overload in the proper area to have the appropriate adaptation pop up. And what is that? Depends by person. We got to find what the low-hanging fruit is, fix that, and move on.
And when you've got an athlete in front of you, right? So let's mm-hmm. say we're taking a 16-year-old and we're looking to improve momentum, right? Yep. So can you talk us through what a 16-year-old who's probably got a relatively low training age, unless they're you, of course, but like most 16-year-olds aren't in the gym 4 years already. So when you've got a young athlete, what are they going to do to increase their momentum?
What they're basically going to do at that point in time is just that general total body 3-day-a-week style training. And we, if they have the tools at that area to see, you know, what are some of the weak, and we also, hey, dude, let's get down to specificity. It's like, how are we timing them? A 16-year-old is probably not going to have any sort of, you know, photocells or radars or things like that. So they're probably just going to have one single stopwatch in time. So what do you do for those people? Well, you just overall, you get them stronger. I mean, it's that simple. That low training age, yep. Squat them, deadlift them, do some glute ham raises, reverse hypers, and let Mother Nature take her course. You know, do that 2-3 times a week, and you're set. And I would probably, at that 16-year-old kid, if they started out just now training, I would probably, here's exactly what I would do. I would start them out with a set of 20 and progress up 5 pounds on every exercise every time that they could. When that gets heavy, go to 1x14, and then we go to 2 sets of 8, and then we run into whatever type of program you would need after that point. Those 16-year-olds, they need a lot of motor learning. 20 repetitions with light weight, they really could start to, you know, increase that myelination, understand the movements, you teach the movements, and then after that first year, you know, you could take the training wheels off and just let it ride and just crush things. But back to the main points, like, what am I going to do with that beginner? I'm going to squat them. I'm going to progressive overload them. And Mother Nature's working her course at that point in time anyway. So you're probably going to see a 3% improvement in speed if you did nothing. So hopefully we're seeing a 4 or 5%, which, you know, always befuddles me. These high school track coaches said, oh, yeah, I've got an average 1.5% improvement in speed. It's like, yeah, Mother Nature's got a 3%. I think it's 3%. So you suck. That's what you're telling me. They don't like to hear that, though. And I've gotten better about doing stuff like that.
I can imagine it's confronting, at least. But so let's say you've got the 16-year-old and they've gone through that program and they're now big and strong.
Yeah,
they're producing momentum. We can throw numbers on it, but let's say they can double body weight squat. They're doing all the good stuff. They're big and powerful, and they've hit that point where they're not getting any faster, and they could be plateauing there. And the mass is taking a lot of effort to get more mass on.
Yep.
At that stage, what's their training going to look like?
Then I would probably still squat them a little bit, like once a week. I'd squat them just to basically maintain strength. Then what their training is going to look like is a lot of single leg stuff, so step ups, Bulgarians, that sort of thing. Now, the reason being is that whenever we increase the need for stabilization, we're going to increase the total amount of muscle mass that's utilized there. Anything that's done bilaterally will be done in a joint angle specificity type thing. So I'll be working a lot of half squats and quarter squats, and I'll also throw in some of the basic sprint special exercises with the band resistance, like the knee drives and the paw backs at that point in time. So it's looking less like a brute force program, and now it's looking more like an athletically based program. You know, I think at the start that, you know, the strength, there's an old statement that strength is the tide that rising tide that floats all ships. And that's true whenever they're young. It stops whenever they get older. And then strength, it's like, you know, you're bailing water and you never took care of the hole in the bottom of the ship. Well, you're going to go down at some point. But that's just that specificity trade-off that we were just mentioning. Yep, you get strong until you don't need to, and then you could work on additional force vectors. Something else that I would do, I mentioned the unilateral movements, is that I would be doing a lot of the hip-initiated style of lunging, where most of the times people come up and they use their torso to get their momentum, their inertia moving forward. Well, no, we don't do that. We stand up and we have instead of a barbell, we're attached to a cable or a band, and then you use that glute to forcefully push you out horizontally. I wrote an article about my lunge progressions and Simply Faster. It's probably been a decade ago now, but I'll probably get 7 years at least. But I describe, you know, how I progress into that throughout the course of the year to get up to those horizontal lunges and go over the technique. And I've got some video to illustrate the technique, because it doesn't matter how much you say something or you write it out. It's still, you know, showing somebody is still a heck of a lot better than that. You know, there's that picture's worth 1,000 words. Well, whenever you're trying to describe something in written word, yeah, it's no shit. Yeah, a picture really is worth 1,000, maybe 5,000 words in some instances. But that really allows that to be clarified. But yeah, going back to that hip-initiated lunge, going out forward, going laterally, I'm really going to be pushing that as well. Because how does the glute work whenever we are in sport? Well, it works as a forceful hip extensor. So I can't imagine, you know, doing a single-leg movement where the glute isn't working as a forceful hip extensor. And it just happens to do it naturally with that force vector, you know, the resistance pulling you back. That really helps that, you know, what we would call feeding the negative, like putting the band around somebody's knees to force them to cave in, to teach them to push out. So, and I really like that. Instead of so much heavy stuff, instead of the heavy deadlifts, we would be doing some sorts of ballistics or an Olympic lift variant if that's what the person does. I don't do a tremendous amount of Olympic lift variants any longer, but I'm also not working with team sport athletes that much. I do a little bit here at Texas A&M. I'm not on the floor coaching anybody. I'll make recommendations. I'm doing more with our tactical first responder and warfighter side of things. And it just doesn't, to me, there's a lot of people like, oh, you got to teach everybody how to do the Olympic weightlifting movements and all this. Like, man, if you've seen their elbows, wrists, and shoulders, they're beat up. Why are we going to inflict any more damage on them? Let's do some swings. Let's do some jumps and move on, man. Everybody talks about the specificity of the Olympic lifts to jumping, but I'll tell you something. I've never seen anything more specific to jumping than jumping, and I've never seen anything more specific to sprinting than sprinting. You can take all the barbells and put it in any manner that you want, and I still have not seen it.
Yeah, some great advice. And before we leave, I want to wrap this up with a nice case study to kind of bring this to life. So you've gone through some different exercises, some different progressions. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're going to get someone into the gym, and let's take the athlete who's already kind of plateaued, and you're looking to really push them on the sport specific side. So can you walk us through how you would then approach that from they're walking into the gym and they've got, let's say, an hour to an hour and a half with you to improve their momentum and sport performance. So how are you going to approach that task?
Well, I'm going to do testing, and I'm going to see where's the low hanging fruit. I'll probably have a timing gate every 5 meters if we don't have a radar sprint laser on them, and we'll do a 30 meter sprint there. And I'll also do multiple loads of resistance for their sprinting and compare that against some normative data that's existing out there or within the data set that I've got. Because, we got to have normal to what? If I compare a college athlete to the average high school kid, of course, they're going to, reach dominance. So, I want to look at that specific data. So we're going to do some sprint testing. We're also going to do some different jump testing, and we'll do a change of direction test. We'll also look at a medical history, and we'll watch the movement to see, hey, is there any low hanging fruit here? And then it's not that I'm trying to avoid the question here, Matt, is I'm going to find out what's the low hanging fruit, and I'm going to move that first. Is it that this person, typically if they're already strong, their squat jump, going down and pausing and exploding up is going to be really good. How does that, fall into line with their counter movement jump? Okay. Are they greater than 80% there? How is that with their, a 40 centimeter drop jump? Okay. How are they using stored elastic energy? Okay, great. How was their start of the sprint? How was their midpoint of the sprint? How was their top end speed? How was their cut? How was their technique? Did they triple flex? So did they flex at the hip, knee, and ankle, or did they, what I see a lot of time is people having poor ankle mobility, so they end up flexing more at the knee and the hip. And then the ankle, the tibia moves forward, but it's because the hip and the knee drop so much rather than a change in dorsiflexion angle. They still might be at fucking neutral, but sorry about that. I dropped an F-bomb. I didn't have any caffeine. So let me come at that again. So I'm going to see if they, their knee is moving forward. Yeah, that's anterior tibial translation that you're going to need, but that dorsiflexion angle might still be neutral looking at the ankle. So how is that? And that's what I'm going to use to build the prescription. I'm also going to done a mid thigh pull. And if we've got it done a mid thigh pull, we've already done a counter movement jump. Well, then of course we've got a dynamic strength index. So that's going to tell me more if he needs some more towards the force or more towards the ballistic. And then with the information coming from the plyometric, from the drop vertical jump, then I'm going to be able to say more about, what type of training does he need as far as that goes? It's probably, I don't know how it is in Europe, but typically we're really good at doing things one time here. And then the utilization of that stored elastic energy, they're not the greatest at. So usually just with a lot of just basic jump training, we can see a lot of good results and good adaptations. But so let's get down to the nitty gritty of exactly what you had asked. So probably what's going to happen is we'll bring him in and we'll probably be doing 2 lower/total body days a week. On one day, it might be slightly more strength oriented. And I'm only saying slightly because they're already strong enough. And that's the day whenever we would probably hit up to around 80-85% of our squat for a few reps. Then we would change and go towards up the load greatly, and then do a few sets of 8 to 12 on some half squats or quarter squats, depending on the time of the year. Half squat would be early, mid to late off season. Quarter squat would be starting into what some people would call the preseason through the mid season. And then at some point in time, we might drop it off just to buy some stuff on their legs. after those couple of exercises are going through, then we would look to be doing some ballistics and some single leg ballistics there as well. So it might be a single leg drive up or doing single leg or split squat jumps, those sorts of things. Train the hip as hard as possible, that the, you know, abductors, external rotators are doing what they're supposed to, and then finish up with just a little bit of stabilization. And on the second day, it's going to be all explosive and ballistic. We need to know whether through a load velocity profile, what does this individual need? Do they need more strength speed? Do they need more speed strength? We'll train towards that on the half squat or quarter squat movement on that second day. Get some more speed and jumping type stuff going on, making sure that we're hitting the calf too. A lot of people forget that the tricep surae is responsible for 80% of propulsive forces. According to the Shachi paper, I believe that was below 7 meters per second. So below a full sprint, your calf is doing a tremendous amount of work. Everybody thinks that they get enough just by walking around and doing other things. And man, I don't know if I agree. Just based upon that sort of information, it seems like, yeah, you know what? It is a high type 1 fiber muscle, so I can understand where some people are coming from, but dude, we got to make sure that Achilles tendon is strong, right? And that it can handle the wear and tear. And also, if you're doing seated calf raises, well, that's going to lengthen out the soleus, right? So then that's going to buy you some more dorsiflexion. And a lot of athletes are restricted with that anyway. So, and I'm definitely going to be doing that on that other day. It's like, am I going to be doing it for speed or for strength? Well, it depends on what the guy needs. If we need more in the tendon, well, we're going to be doing more strength and ISO. If we're needing more ballistic power out of it, then yeah, sure, shit, why not do it for speed? It should be fine. But so then those 2 days, that's what it's going to be looking like. And what is going to be the exercise? Well, that's going to depend on the position of the person, the sport, of course. But I mean, that's a pretty good basic outline for it, is that, hey, you know, after the full squats, if you're not seeing speed improvement and jumping improvements, go to half. If you're not seeing improvements after that, go to quarters. Oh, actually, after half, let me back that up, is that after I run my strength block from it, I'll go find where they hit peak power at. And with the creation of a load velocity profile, I always look at power as well. And I want to see where power occurs. And if power occurring where I would expect it to? And if not, I need to use my velocity-based training style program to start moving that peak power to occur where it should. It's like, where should peak power occur? Well, there's some studies that are out there. Kawamori and Hoff put out a great paper 15, 20 years ago about, it might be longer than that now, hell, I can't remember. But it was about optimal load for various exercises, and it varies between populations. So you knock out, you know, you figure out what that optimal load is. That's where peak power should be occurring. And where am I at? Am I more towards the velocity end of the spectrum? Well, I might be weak. If I'm more towards the low load end of the spectrum, I might be strong, but I'm very slow. So then I'm going to go ahead and, you know, meet in the middle where they need to be through the load prescription. So the exercise prescription, of course, is paramount, but that load to make sure that we're training the appropriate qualities is of utmost importance as well.
Absolutely excellent. So, Brian, massive thanks for your time and effort. It's been a pleasure talking. It's been really interesting hearing your thoughts on it too.
Yeah,
my pleasure. Where can people find a little bit more about you and what you're up to?
Oh, shoot, I don't know. I'm on social media, J. Brian Mann, Brian with a Y. It's the same on all the platforms that I'm on. My email is the same, jbrianmann@tamu.edu. They can, you know, keep up with me, you know, with following on social media is probably going to be about the best bet. I need to start a website. I haven't gotten around to it yet. I've been saying I need to do that for about, 15 years now. I haven't gotten to it. Probably not going to be doing it anytime soon either, unless I pay somebody to do it, because that's a whole other language. I can speak English. I can speak Spanish and redneck. I don't think I need to put web design on there too.
It's so sometimes it's a case of staying to what you're good at and allowing other people to do the more difficult things for you, right?
That's what I'm hoping to do one of these days.
Excellent. So, Brian, massive thanks. It's been a pleasure talking, and I look forward to speaking again soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks to Brian for all of his hard work on today's podcast. I really appreciate it. I'm sure you do at home too. Before you leave, I want to point you in the direction of the Science of Sport Coach Academy. The Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses, which are broken down into bite-sized chunks. So if you enjoyed today's podcast and want to get your hands on some more great sports science information, all you have to do is hit the link in the show notes so you can get into the Coach Academy completely for free for the next 7 days. And of course, if you have enjoyed today's podcast, it'd be fantastic if you could recommend us to a coach, a colleague, an athlete, or a friend. That means we keep bringing the best possible guests and best possible content. And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks from me, I'm Matt Solomon of Science and Sport, and I'll speak to you next week.